Hi, I'm Steve Kenson of Green Ronin Publishing. You're listening to The Tome Show.
This is Ethan.
Nathan.
And Jeremy.
We are from Gamers Haven Podcast, and you are listening to
GBNcom.com, the Goblin Broadcast Network.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 55. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be settling a few things with 4th edition settings. Welcome again to episode 55 of The Tome, 4th edition settings with Chris Engler. Some quick announcements for our posting wall. First, don't forget to stop by the forum. I'm working on some things including the Tome's Summer 2008 contest. Come and give your input and see what you'd like to see from that, as well as let me know what you'd like to see from my trip to Origins this year. Of course, we'll also be chatting about 4th edition. Over at the forums, just like we are in this episode. And if you're interested in pre-ordering your 4th edition books or finishing up your 3rd edition collection, don't forget to swing by the Tome's Amazon store and help support the show. The store has all sorts of D&D related things on it, from D&D minis to novels and more. Plus, right now, the pre-order price for 4th edition is really good, but it has started to creep upwards, so order it now and lock in the lowest price possible, and support the show along the way. Expect another blitz of episodes this week, as I am on spring break from teaching, and I'm hoping to produce at least 5 episodes before I have to get back to the classroom. I have quite a backlog of content ready to go, and several things that I've read and prepared reviews for but haven't recorded yet, and so there's a lot that I want to get through. So expect things to speed up here for a little while, and then I'll probably get back to my normal routine. Well, with that, I'm going to move right into the meat of this chapter of the Tome. Chris Engler from WAP Caplets and I are talking about settings for 4th edition. My usual warning, of course, applies. All information was current at the time of recording, but the books aren't out yet, so things and information have been changing. So some things might be out of date, but it is all from official sources. More information can be discussed on the forums. So without any more chatter, here's myself and Chris Engler talking about 4th edition settings. All right, so we're back again, Chris Engler and Jeff Greiner talking 4th edition. This time we're going to talk about some of the setting news. When we talk about setting news, some of that is going to mean specific settings, like the Forgotten Realms or Eberron or Greyhawk. Some of that is going to mean some of the overall setting assumptions that are basic to the game itself. Some of it's going to be specific to some people, and some of it's going to be attached to everybody who plays the game. Let's start off by looking at some of the general ideas, some of the general assumptions in the core books about setting. One of the things that's come out a lot and been discussed quite a bit, rather controversially, is the idea of what they're calling the points of light idea. And basically this means that they're assuming that in any given game world, adventurers are rare, civilization will exist in rare little locations all over the world, and everything will sort of have a frontier feel to it.
Yeah, that's a pretty big shift.
It is. It's a very significant shift. And they say that it won't necessarily be applied to existing worlds. Of course, some of the things that we've learned in the last week or so about the Forgotten Realms, turns out that's not necessarily true, but I'll talk more about that later. But it is a big shift to sort of say there is these points of light civilization in a otherwise wilderness covered world.
Well, and the other thing, you know, D&D traditionally didn't have sort of in third edition anyway, didn't have, you know, you look in the player's handbook, there's not a world map, you know what I mean? It's sort of, these are rules for a magic-rich fantasy role-playing system, and then you can tack that on to either your own setting or, you know, a bunch of other settings that we'll will make available to you.
So, yeah, and I'll be curious because, I mean, making these broad assumptions and sort of like what you're getting at there is it seems to me that it's eliminating some option. I mean, if you're making an assumption that every campaign world has certain things, then what happens if I want to run a campaign world that doesn't have those things? Is your game not going to be suited to my desires?
Right. It's definitely narrowing the focus because, you know, I've heard game designers say, you know, if something's important in your world, then there will be system things to reflect it. So if the general feel of the world is, like they say, going to be very frontier-like, then it would be my expectation that, you know, survival skills and hunting skills and things like that will become a much bigger part of the game. You know, in any D&D campaign that I've played in, it's usually the case that, you know, you're in a world where, you know, there are big established cities and things like that. And even though there's definitely the opportunity to travel to remote locations, that's not the default setting.
Well, I think a big part of what they're trying to accomplish is less mobility for common people in a campaign setting, that you sort of establish yourself a base of operations, and it's the adventurous and powerful sort of people, like the characters, that are the ones running out into the wilderness and fighting the monsters, and nobody else is really doing that because it's too dangerous.
Yeah, I guess so.
And there's also some new assumptions changing regarding the cosmology, and we've talked a little bit about some of this. We mentioned the Feywild earlier during our monsters conversation, and basically it's going to be a parallel Earth where the geography of the, you know, the normal world is reflected in the Feywild, but in the Feywild you've got all of your fairies and that sort of thing.
So kind of like when Frodo puts the ring on.
Sort of like that, although that might be more akin to the next one, which is called the Shadowfell, which is sort of a dark parallel world. The dead still linger there. It's a dark reflection of the mortal world. So you have two sort of parallel worlds that overlap, I guess, with the normal, you know, material world.
So that's going to be interesting. So if a physical feature changes in one, is it reflected in the others?
I believe that's the way it works. I mean, there might be general, you know, specific discrepancies, but in general, the physical features and geography are the same or similar.
That's a big change. That's going to make for some interesting role play, and that's going to make planar themes and adventures probably a lot more commonplace, wouldn't you think?
Well, there might be some of that, and I think part of it is, because, I mean, they've sort of done some of that already with, at least in some campaign settings, with, you know, the Plane of Shadow or the Ethereal Plane. They've done some of that parallel world sort of stuff before. So I guess I don't particularly see that as a huge change, except that they're changing what those planes are. I mean, the Shadowfell is pretty much the Plane of Shadow as it's been presented in some other campaign settings. But the Feywild is very different, and it seems to me that they're trying to bring more of this sort of fairy concept into the game than what there was before. I mean, they always sort of hinted at it and said that there was some of this kind of stuff going on, but they never really established it in a firm way like it seems like they're going to do now.
Yeah, I guess it'll be interesting to see, because whenever you're running parallel worlds like that, I mean, my question is always, well, how parallel are they? Like, you know, if I chop down this tree in the Feywild, does that tree just fall down mysteriously in the material world? You know, things like that. You know, just continuity management.
Sure.
Is something that, you know, makes me curious.
And then some of the other new planes they're talking about is a plane called the Elemental Chaos. They're taking all of the old elemental planes that used to be the inner planes, you know, the plane of fire and earth and wind and water, and they're turning it into this new area called the Elemental Chaos, where all of the elemental energy in existence is sort of tied to this chaotic, swirling mix of elemental energy.
So is it going to be a place you can actually go, or is it just this void where, you know, fire, water, air, and earth are flying all over the place.
I'm under the assumption that it, just like previous editions, it'll be a plane that you can visit. In fact, that is the new location of the Abyss. The Abyss is actually a pocket inside of the Elemental Chaos.
I see.
And then the other new big plane idea that they've introduced is this thing called the Astral Sea. Instead of having just the astral plane, they've given it a more specific name and called it the Astral Sea, and say that this is the realm of the mind and the soul. This is where gods go. This is where you go when you die. And so all of the other planes that we've known are all going to be somewhere within this area called the Astral Sea.
So it is a physical plane as opposed to just something purely metaphysical and conceptual?
It seems that there's going to be some element of that, yeah. I mean, previously, you know, we've had Hell and we've had, you know, Mechanus and we've had all these, you know, myriad of planes. But now they're going to say that there's just the four planes and all these other things sort of exist within those. And so, you know, Mechanus might be an existent plane, but it's just a place in the Astral Sea. So it seems like they're trying to simplify things more and then categorize everything into those four categories.
Interesting.
And then along with our planar discussion, it makes sense to chat briefly about the gods. The way that they're presenting gods in the Player's Handbook now is quite a bit different than what they've done in the past. In the past, in third edition, when they gave examples of gods, they gave examples of the gods from Greyhawk. With fourth edition, they're going to give examples of gods that are just sort of a smattering of gods from all over the place. And it seems like they're maybe going further away from a core setting. You know, these are not the gods of a core setting. You're not assumed to be in a world that has all these gods. But they're trying to give you a sampling of gods from all over the place just to give you an idea of what kind of gods can exist. So it sounds like there may be more of examples than they are core settings types of gods.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure what they were getting at. And D&D has always been a game that I felt is kind of god crazy. You know, there's way too many. But that's not to say that you're compelled to use all of them in your own games.
Sure. Well, and personally, I'm a big fan of, a complex pantheon of gods, but that comes down to my long-time experience with the Forgotten Realms, which has just about as complex a pantheon as exists in the world. But
right. Where I find it gets clunky and runs into each other is there's some, you know, I mean, you've got your pantheistic worldviews and your theistic worldviews, and you know, by definition, you know, it's kind of tough for those to exist side by side because, you know, gods exist in D&D in, you know, a very literal way. You know, people are, you know, well, I guess players know that, you know, if there's a god listed in a book that's statted out, then that god exists. You know, even though the characters and people within that game may not believe in each other's gods, you know, when you're outside of the universe looking in, you know that, you know, you can enumerate all the gods that actually exist. And you know, I always found it hard in D&D to sort of wrap my mind around the fact that, you know, these various pantheons that all had their own mythologies and, you know, origin stories and things like that, you know, those all existing simultaneously just kind of didn't compute to me. So personally, you know, I favor more towards the idea of setting up a pantheon that's, you know, well-defined and consistent throughout your whole game universe. So I guess if they're not committing to a core setting and just saying, okay, here's some examples of gods, they're leaving it to you to do that.
Sure. And I can sort of get, yeah, I mean, you're right. In the D&D sort of assumed world or universe or whatever, there is very little room for a lot of wiggle room in terms of the gods. I mean, we generally know who they are because every now and then they start walking around. You know, they show up for dinner and you can't really say they don't exist.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, they've got stats, therefore they're real.
Right. Now, the specific gods that they've mentioned will be in the player's handbook are Moradin, Bahamut, Pelor, Kord, Corlon, Bane, Zihir, and Torog. Those last two being new ones that they've created, Bane being a Forgotten Realms god, Corlon coming both from Greyhawk and the Forgotten Realms. He's one of those that is carried over to both. Moradin's done the same thing. Pelor and Kord are Greyhawk, and Bahamut's been in a lot of different settings, as I understand.
Right. Well, I mean, originally Bahamut was the, you know, when I hear Bahamut, my default image in my mind is the Platinum Dragon from first edition.
Right. So those are... go ahead.
Oh, nothing. Go ahead.
Well, so those are the gods that you can expect to see in the player's handbook, and I suppose there might be more than that, but those are the ones we definitely know about. Now we're going to get into some stuff that's a little more setting-specific that we know about. Now, there is a lot of news out there in terms of the Forgotten Realms, because that's going to be the first setting that they put out. The Forgotten Realms campaign setting, they say, is going to be released in August of 2008. And they did manage to get Ed Greenwood involved in writing it. He is writing 50,000 words of the book. Ed Greenwood being, for those of you who aren't Realmsians like myself, was the original creator of the Forgotten Realms. And so they've gotten him involved and brought him back to write 50,000 words of the new book. There's been a lot of information about how this is going to come down and what it's going to look like in the new campaign setting. And so a lot of the information we have deals with the Forgotten Realms. But we do have some smatterings of some other stuff too. The Realms will be going through some pretty significant changes. There's a large event that's going to happen called the Spell Plague that is going to sort of explain the change from 3.5 to 4th edition in the Realms.
Yeah, I've heard a bit about that, and I'm just curious, what's been the reaction of Forgotten Realm fans to that?
Well,
as varied as the hairs on your head?
Originally, I guess the reaction was... It seems to me that the reaction has been generally negative. Not necessarily the idea of having a large world-changing event, because they've done that before. When D&D went from 2nd edition to 3rd edition and from 1st edition to 2nd edition, in both cases, the Forgotten Realms went through some big changes. The reactions that I've been hearing are generally not real positive. But at the same time, if I think about them logically, I can sort of understand why they're doing some of it. They're jumping forward in time a significant amount of years. And they're changing a lot of things and eliminating whole continents, creating whole new continents, and making the world generally very, very new. And under the idea of bringing in new players... that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, because, I mean, the amount of lore that you have to absorb, you know, I mean, if I was going to start playing Forgotten Realms with you, I mean, I'd probably have 3 months of reading to do to even come close to being able to converse intelligently with you, knowing that you know the realm so thoroughly.
Well, I think that's part of what they're trying to eliminate. On the other hand, the people who don't currently play the realms are not the people that are giving opinions about it, right? The people who are upset about the changes are people who are currently playing in it. And they already have the background and the knowledge. And that's where I think the anger is coming from. Because you're only hearing the side of the story from people who already like it the way it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, I mean, to get the whole picture, I guess you'll have to...
I'll have to wait.
Get feedback from people that are relatively new to see how they like it.
Yeah, because, I mean, personally, in my opinion, simplifying the realms because they're killing off a lot of the gods and simplifying the pantheon. They're making everything very much match a lot of the philosophy and rules of fourth edition. And they're jumping far enough ahead in time that a lot of the historians that, you know a lot about the realms, a lot of what they know isn't going to be particularly or immediately relevant, I guess, to the game world anymore. So as one of those people who's really into the realms, that's something that sort of I can see the anger that can create because, you know, what have I gone through all these years of learning and knowing and getting all this complex information and understanding this complex culture and understanding the complex god system, and now they've just taken it all away from me.
So yeah, I can understand that.
So I guess one of the responses that I've seen that makes sense to me is if you don't want to play in that kind of a complex world, then don't play the Forgotten Realms. And if you do, you've got the option. And it seems like maybe one of the changes, one of the things they're doing is taking away those options now. You don't have that incredibly complex world anymore to play in because they're changing it.
Right.
So I guess that's where I think a lot of the anger comes from. They have taken in some feedback as far as what's going to happen with the realms. What happened was they released a book called A Grand History of the Realms, which is basically a whole book that's just a timeline. And I'll be talking about it myself on another episode. But they took some of the feedback from that timeline, and in that timeline they actually went forward 10 years past the current year. So people started to get a bit of a taste of what was going to happen to the realms in the new edition. And they took some of that feedback and they did make some changes and some tweaks to what would be happening in the Forgotten Realms. So Wizards isn't completely oblivious to what's going on with their fan base.
Well, I bet it had a lot to do with the fact that, think of the amount of stuff that they would have to import in order to keep the continuity if they just left the realms as is. I mean, that's probably more work than they have people to do.
Yeah, I imagine there's an element of that also. One other bit of interesting news, and I think this might tie into the whole situation also, is that the Living Greyhawk system is disappearing for 4th edition. And for 4th edition, instead, we get the Living Forgotten Realms. And so since they're giving a lot of responsibility to RPGA to run this Living Forgotten Realms idea, they wanted to, I think, make it a little bit more digestible for everybody who isn't a Realms expert.
Right.
Because obviously you want it to be very successful. They say there's going to be 12 regions in the world, 6 U.S. regions and 6 regions outside of the U.S. that will correspond to real geography in the Forgotten Realms. So if I'm playing in the central United States, then there is, the games that I'm playing in directly correspond to what's happening in a specific place in the Forgotten Realms. And if I'm living in Asia, then I'm affecting the storyline of a completely different part of the realms.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how that... that point that turns out. What's been the reaction to the phasing out of the Living Greyhawk?
I think people aren't sure how to react yet because from what I've seen, they haven't talked much about what is going to happen to Greyhawk. There are fans of the Living Greyhawk system, but they just want, I think from what I understand, a lot of them just want to have Greyhawk to play in. And so far, there's been no talk about whether or not there is or is not going to be a Greyhawk campaign setting.
Maybe it's just going to be one of those things like some of the old second edition systems or settings, where people just, a group of people just sort of take it on themselves and just operate it outside of Wizards.
Yeah, and that could be. And I could see, at one point there was some implication that Wizards was going to put out new campaign settings on a regular basis.
And just maybe not go real in-depth super supporting them, but, you know, a few books and saying, here, if you want to play Dragonlance, here's a few books that give you the groundwork. Now take it and go with it. You know, and they could do the same thing with, here's a few books on Greyhawk. If you want to take it and run with it, go with it. And we'll put out two or three books, and then we're going to stop, and you can do what you want with it. And I could see that being fairly successful.
See, I'm not so sure about that, because that was part of what TSR did in their dying days, was just crank out setting after setting after setting after setting, and just they just kept piling up.
But I think the difference is that what the TSR was doing was they were trying to fully support setting after setting after setting after setting. If you just say, I'm going to put out two or three books, you can play it and then we're done, I don't think that's necessarily going to hurt anything, because that just means, oh, well, tonight I want to play Dragonlance. Tonight I want to play Planescape. Tonight I want to play whatever. And I've got all, you know, I can pull out the two or three books I need and do it.
So you mentioned Dragonlance. Do we have news about Dragonlance?
I don't have any specific news about Dragonlance at this point, no. Obviously, we know that they've pulled the license back. And Wizards now controls that license again. It used to be under, they had licensed it out to Margaret Weiss Productions, which makes sense.
Now, when did that get reclaimed? Because I thought, and tell me if I'm remembering this wrong, but I thought Margaret Weiss thought they lost it, then they got it back for a while.
Right. They had lost it and then talked to Wizards and got an extension on it, I think, because they had already had some products coming down the pipe that they wanted to put out. But by the time 4th edition comes along, I'm pretty sure it's back out of their hands. It's back to Wizards.
So I know that there's people that really like the stuff that Margaret Weiss Productions put out, so it'll be interesting to see if fans of Dragonlance follow the brand from one studio to another again.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what happens, because, I mean, from what I've heard, I haven't heard any news from Wizards as far as what's going to happen with that license, whether or not they're going to shop it back out again, or whether they're going to try to develop Dragonlance in-house again, or just let it disappear and not support it at all. I have no idea what's going to happen with that. And I'll be curious to see, because Dragonlance is one of those things that I used to play in Dragonlance and haven't touched it in years, and I'm kind of curious to go back to it at some point and give it another shot.
Because Dragonlance kind of got a bit of a black eye recently, because they made that animated movie, and I haven't seen it yet. I'd like to, but I haven't heard very many positive reviews about it.
Yeah, I haven't either. I've got a reviewer for the show who has watched it and wants to do a review of it, and I want to watch it, and I've got somebody from Fistful of Comics who wants to get in on it, and I think we're going to do once we've all seen it, we're going to get together and do sort of a three-way chit-chat about what we liked and what we didn't like about it, but so that will be coming down the pipe on the tome, but we haven't gotten to a point where we're ready to talk about it yet. But yeah, I haven't heard much that's good about it either, but I've tried to stay away from a lot of reviews and specifics, just because if I'm going to review it myself, I want to come at it from a clean slate.
For sure.
Then the last little bit of setting news that we have to talk about deals with Eberron, which is the newer, I guess, campaign setting for D&D. There has been some... This is because Eberron is further down the line than the Forgotten Realms. It seems like Wizards is still very flexible with what happens to it. Originally, they had said that they were going to jump forward in time a certain number of years, somewhere between 2 and 7 years, I've heard a range. They were going to jump ahead in time in the timeline and make some big changes to the world, and a bunch of people got really upset about it. And so, and Wizards turned around and said, "Oh, well, okay, if you guys don't like it, no changes."
That doesn't surprise me, because when did Eberron first come out? Was that 2003?
It hasn't been that long. It's only been a few years, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't see the need. You know, there's not enough history there to need to reboot the setting the same way that they're doing for Forgotten Realms. So I'm surprised they even thought of doing that.
Well, and I think a lot of it was, we just need to have something happen in the world that explains that things work differently now. Because with 4th edition, things just simply work differently. There's different people with different abilities than what existed in 3rd edition. And so they wanted to sort of have an event that explained that. And I think they've just sort of decided, instead of doing that, let's just go back and say that this is just the way it's always been. You know, there's no point in having to go through a big event to explain it all.
Right.
And I've noticed they've been a lot less into continuity when it comes to Eberron. I think Wizards has sort of wanted to avoid falling into the same continuity hole that they've fallen into with the realms.
Well, Eberron, that's, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the first campaign setting that Wizards produces that was birthed out of Wizards. Like, everything else sort of was inherited from TSR, more or less.
I believe you, that's right.
So, you know, I guess they have the freedom to do whatever they want with that, because it's a property that they created and controlled. I mean, I know that was the, you know, they didn't technically create it, because that was the winner of the design series, but I mean, it's one that they also brought to life on their own.
Right, and I think what they wanted to do is they had at that point dealt with other campaign settings that had a long history and continuity. And they've said, you know what, they've just made the decision a few years ago, I think, that they've said, we're not going to worry about continuity. Nope. They said, we're not going to worry about continuity. So even to the point of the novels that come out set in the Eberron world, they say none of the events in the novels will impact the game books at all. Those events will be assumed to not happen. The events in the novels won't affect any events in other novels. There is no common shared timeline. It's just, this is the world, and we'll keep putting out new information about it. But we're not going to have a shared continuous timeline, so that we never run into these continuity hiccups. And the heroes of the world will always be your characters, and not whoever was in that novel or this novel.
That's probably a good idea, to make it easy on themselves, because, you know, with any licensed property, I mean, it's, you know, the fans are far more aware of the continuity than the creators in most cases.
Right. And one of the things that came out of a lot of that backlash for them originally saying they were going to make big changes in Eberron is they've now said, you know, every race that was going to, that is in Eberron now will continue to be there. Every Dragonmark will continue to exist. Very little will be changing, other than just tweaking the rules to put in the fourth edition.
Good. And I mean, that's probably the way it should be for something that's as new as Eberron.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Any last thoughts on campaign setting news, or setting news in general?
I wonder if they'll have the guts to re-release Spelljammer.
Spelljammer was a real love-hate situation, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a small group of people that really love it, and a huge group of people that really hate it.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where I've played some Spelljammer and back in my second edition days, and for those of you who don't know, Spelljammer was a system and a setting in second edition that basically involved big boats flying around in space. It was sort of a combination D&D space opera sort of system or setting. And it had some, on one hand, I really liked some of the fun, fresh sort of ideas that came out of it. And on the other hand, it did sometimes come off a little bit corny.
What, you didn't like the fact that the boats were powered by giant hamsters?
Right.
and the hippo people, what were they called?
The GIF.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, somebody was probably engaging in some recreational pharmaceuticals when they dreamed some of that stuff up.
Yeah. They certainly weren't in a normal state of mind.
I'm not holding my breath for fourth ed Spelljammer.
I'm going to say probably not. Okay, well, that's our discussion then about the setting news for 4th edition. Well, that's for our 4th edition setting chat. Now for a quick promo from a podcast novel that is completed now, but I've only just started listening to, at patiobooks.com.
Heroes. The very word conjures images of women and men in noble costumes, paragons of virtue, harnessing powers beyond comprehension to fight for justice and defend good against the plots and ravages of evil. Keepsy Branson once dreamed of being a hero, but she and the other members of the so-called third wave of superpowered humans have been judged to have abilities too weak and useless to be formally trained as heroes by the Academy. But as a villainous plot threatens to tear Seventh City apart, what Keepsy and her friends learn is that in a world in which so-called heroes are manufactured by greed and driven more by agenda than principle, true heroism isn't about the strength of your powers or the shine of your costume. True heroes are those who make difficult choices for good with the powers that they have, whatever those may be. Playing for Keeps is the new novel by Murr Lafferty, available for free via podcast in both audio and PDF formats, and now available for purchase in print. For more information, please visit playingforkeepsnovel.com.
Okay, well, this has been episode 55 of The Tome. As always, I want to encourage you to send in your feedback or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com. Swing by the forum at thetomeshow.com. Notice with iTunes or Podcast Alley or Podcast Pickle. But more than that, tell anyone you know that might be interested about the show. Word of mouth goes a long way to helping the show find its audience. Also, don't forget to consider checking out The Tome's Amazon store. The show gets a part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And once again, you can find all of this at thetomeshow.com. Also, don't forget to check out The Tome's partner podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, at fistfulofcomics.com for all sorts of geeky goodness, and Gamers Haven at canadiancrusaders.com for some great GMly advice, where they recently discussed what to do when you have to kick somebody out of your game. This has been episode 55, 4th edition settings of...
The Tome.